masters of war. You who build all the guns, you that build all the planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind. I just want you to know I can see through your masks. You've never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's yours. And you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run faster when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me. See through your eyes and I see through your brain like I see through the water that runs down my dreams. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled, a fear to bring children to the world, for threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good?
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program, Jeremy Scahill takes us inside America's covert war. The soldiers in these battles operate globally and inside the United States with orders from the White House to do anything necessary to hunt down, capture, or kill individuals designated by the president as enemies. Jeremy Scahill reveals covert operations unknown to the public and carried out across the globe by men who do not exist on paper and will never appear before Congress, raising questions about freedom and democracy, war and justice, morality and politics. He's interviewed by Terrence McNally, journalist and radio host.
How much do you know about the covert wars the U.S. is involved in around the globe? Stay tuned for the next hour and you'll know a lot more. What begins as an investigation by award-winning journalist Jeremy Scahill into a U.S. night raid gone terribly wrong in a remote corner of Afghanistan quickly transforms into a high-stakes global investigation into the rise of JSOC, that's Joint Special Operations Command, the most secret and elite fighting force in U.S. history. In military jargon, JSOC teams, quote, find, fix, and finish, unquote, their targets who are selected through a secret process. No target is off limits for the kill list, including U.S. citizens. It's the unbounded, unending war on terror. All bets are off and almost anything goes. We have fundamentally changed the rules of the game and the rules of engagement. Today, drone strikes, night raids, U.S. government-condoned torture occur, and they generate unprecedented civilian casualties. Dirty Wars, the new bestseller by Jeremy Scahill, reveals covert operations unknown to the public and carried out across the globe by men who do not exist on paper and will never appear before Congress, raising questions about freedom and democracy, war and justice, morality and politics. No matter how little you know about these actions, they are being done in your name. Dirty Wars is also a documentary, which will open in theaters June 7th. Here in Freeform, we explore the lives and work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, and media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Jeremy Scahill, national security correspondent for The Nation magazine, has reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Nigeria, Yemen, the former Yugoslavia, and elsewhere across the globe. His work has sparked several congressional investigations and won some of journalism's highest honors. He has twice awarded the prestigious George Polk Award in 1998 for foreign reporting and in 2008 for his book Blackwater. He's the writer with David Riker and producer of the documentary feature film Dirty Wars, which, as I said, opens in theaters in June. Scahill is author of the New York Times bestsellers Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and his latest, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Welcome, Jeremy Scahill, to Freeform.
It's really an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about, so I gave a brief bio there. But could you, in your own words, briefly tell us the path to the kind of work you're doing today?
Yeah, it really, I think, is a bit of an unorthodox story. Both of my parents are nurses, and I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And my dad, actually, I was just telling a friend, my dad had wanted to be a priest. We're an Irish Catholic family when he was growing up. And he then met this platinum blonde, who was not a natural platinum blonde, working in a hospital. And sort of the world changed a lot for my dad's sort of aspirations. Anyway, we grew up in Milwaukee, and I had actually wanted to be a school teacher. I wanted to work in economically disadvantaged areas. I wanted to teach middle school, and I started off going to the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And found out that I was not very good at school myself. So I wanted to be a teacher, but I wasn't very good at being taught.
Being a student.
Yeah, it wasn't that like I was some party kid or something. I was a voracious reader, but I just didn't like the classroom. And I ended up leaving school with the intention of coming back. And I hitchhiked out to Washington, D.C., and I moved into this homeless shelter called the Community for Creative Nonviolence, which was run by Mitch Snyder, who was sort of a famous activist who passed away. So I arrived at this place, and I was going to work with people who were homeless. And I spent a lot of time taking like veterans to apply for their benefits, and a tremendous number of homeless veterans from the Vietnam War and some from the Korean War. And I ended up listening to a lot of talk radio, right wing, left wing, everything. And I heard this woman on the radio, and she was talking about the rebels who were in the mountains fighting to overthrow the U.S.-backed dictatorship of Mobutu Sese Seko. And I had never heard of Mobutu Sese Seko. I had never heard of rebels in mountains. I mean, I was not real. I didn't grow up all that political at all. It turns out it was Amy Goodman.
And what year is this?
And this would have been around 96. So it was right when Democracy Now! Started.
Right.
And I basically started to stalk Amy Goodman. And I mean, she and I have some good laughs about this now. But, I started off writing. I didn't have email or anything. I started off writing her letters. And then I had come to New York. And I wasn't writing her creepy letters. I was saying, I want to be a part of that and
yeah.
do it, sort of what you do. And I ended up, I was living in New York and continuing to work with people on the streets. And I would go to events that Amy Goodman would do and come up to her. And I think, and I just said, you know, I'll do anything. If you have a dog, I'll walk your dog, or I'll feed your cats, or I'll wash your windows. And I think, and, you know, I said, I want to volunteer on your show. And I thought she had an army of like 400 people working for her or something. So I was
well, she does now.
Right. That's the, democracy was very different than it, it used to be. And I think she had to decide whether to like get a restraining order against me or like let me come in to volunteer. So she let me come in and I sort of never left. And to this day, I list Democracy Now on like my social media stuff as my university because I learned journalism as a trade. I've never taken a journalism class in my life. And, you know, and I started off on the technical side of radio, doing the editing on reel-to-reel tapes, which you know well here.
Yes.
And I love, I miss the reel-to-reel tapes. So I started off learning journalism as a trade and had an opportunity to go to Nigeria with Amy in 1998. And that really whet my appetite for wanting to do international reporting. And so what I basically was doing, Amy was paying me out of her own pocket for about a year when I was working on Democracy Now. I think she was paying me something like 20 or 30 bucks a day. I would get up in the morning. I loved it. I mean, it was like one of my favorite moments in life. I would get up, take the train from the Lower East Side of Manhattan up to Times Square to this newsstand that had every newspaper in the world, and I would buy it. And then I would go into, at the time, there was a smoking room at WBAI, and it was old school WBAI, the New York Pacifica station. It was across the street from Madison Square Garden on the 35th floor of this building.
Oh, my God.
And I mean, it was like at the end of an era. You know, there were these amazing people there, but they had a smoking room, and I would sit in there and chain smoke and write the morning headlines, and Amy was paying me 20, 30 bucks out of her pocket to do it. But I grew up in community media. I mean, KPFK is a very familiar place for me. I've been here many, many times. I love the Pacifica Archives. And, you know, it's really, I feel at home sitting here with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's the voice of Jeremy Scahill. And
you can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
It's harder to fix something than it is to break it. It's harder to live a life than it is to take it. It's harder to think it through than to just do what you want to do with no regard for the consequences. It's harder to feed a child than it is to starve it. It's harder to stop a war than it is to start it. It's harder to see the truth than to just buy the lies they feed you. But these things have their consequences. In the hallowed halls of power, right at this very hour, they are shaking the dice of the future. When they're through with the game that they play in our name, we'll be left to deal with the consequences. It's harder to stand than it is to lie down. It's harder to meet them in eye than to just stare at the ground. And it's harder to see who is the ends and who's the means if you don't think about the consequences. Harder to keep hope alive than to just give up and step aside. But these things have their consequences. We gotta storm the halls of power right at this very hour. We gotta wake them up and make them take notice. We will not lend our strength to leaders who refuse to think of the way of the consequences. We gotta storm the halls of power right at this very hour. We gotta wake them up and make them take notice.
Now, it's still a long road from writing the headlines every day to first of all, doing the investigative journalism that you've done for your last two books, and second, writing books that people love reading. So first, tell me how you ventured into the investigative journalism, how you got your feet wet, and how you threw yourself into this.
Right. Well, as I said, Amy and I went to Nigeria in 98, and we produced a documentary called Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. And that was really the first time that I'd ever been a part of something where you were directly in confrontation with powerful, very powerful individuals, in this case, a huge oil corporation, Chevron. And I watched how Amy, who is just this sort of fearless character, took to task the heads of Chevron in Nigeria for their involvement in massacring villagers in the Niger Delta who were protesting against the environmental destruction of their community, and sort of watched how she just wouldn't take no for an answer. And then also, we worked for weeks piecing together this piece of investigative journalism. And from then on, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And I had a chance in 98. I was invited to go on a delegation to Iraq with this group called Voices in the Wilderness. And you know, people, for young people in particular, don't necessarily know this history, but I cut my teeth in journalism under the last Democratic president, under Clinton. And Iraq was a country that was being targeted economically by the United States through its sanctions policy. And then Clinton had initiated the longest sustained bombing campaign since Vietnam under the guise of the North and South no-fly zones. And so I was invited by a friend of my dad's, actually, who was working with Voices in the Wilderness, named Kathy Kelly, who's been on KPFK many times. And they were going over to Iraq, and they were having trouble finding any journalists that were willing to cover the story. And she said, I know that you're not a really experienced journalist, but would you at all be interested in this? And so I remember scrounging up money and asking, I had an aunt and uncle who I thought were wealthy. I mean, I had no idea. I mean, growing up in a household, with two nurses, I had no concept of how obscenely rich some people are in the world. So they were people that basically had more than a few thousand dollars in a savings account, and I thought that they were rich because they would sometimes pay for all of us to go out for dinner. So I asked them, I thought it was a huge amount of money. I asked them if they would be willing to give me $500. And to me, it felt like asking someone for like their house. And they ended up giving me $500, and then I raised 20, 50, 100 from other people, and Amy gave me some money to get the plane ticket. And so I went to Iraq in 1998, and it was right before the Clinton administration bombed Baghdad in this Operation Desert Fox. And Iraq really changed my life. I mean, I traveled through the hospitals of southern Iraq where kids had these babies were being born with birth defects that didn't exist in medical journals as a result of our use of depleted uranium munitions. And the Iraqis had unintentionally given me a multiple entry visa. It was very difficult to get a visa to Iraq at the time, but they gave me a multiple entry visa. And so I ended up really starting to cover Iraq. But this is before Bush was president, before 9/11, and got to know that country very, very well. And I ended up doing a similar thing, going to cover the bombing of Serbia in 1999, reported on the ground there, and was reporting for, at the time it was Pacifica Network News and Democracy Now. And I would record interviews. A lot of my reporting, if you go back and listen to it, was really trying to give the microphone to people who lived on the other side of the barrel of the gun of U.S. foreign policy. And I wasn't doing any investigative reporting. What I was doing was trying to facilitate the stories of people who were being targeted in our bombings or in U.S. bombings or economically, to give them the microphone. And I would file my reports by phone, and I would edit them on this little little digital recorder, and then I would clamp the headphone over the telephone and then file back the reports. And sometimes I would you give your narration, then you play a cut, then you give your narration, then you play a cut into the phone. And so I started to sort of become a kind of traveling journalist who, I mean in retrospect, it was just insane that I would do it. I mean, I would go to a place with less than $1,000 and figure out a way to stay for a month or 6 weeks, and I don't think I ever made more than $14,000 in a year doing this kind of reporting. But that would have been a good year. And I ended up living in Yugoslavia and traveling from Yugoslavia to Iraq a lot, working for Free Speech Radio News, or sometimes I would work for German radio. And I basically, when young people come up to me and say, I want to do this kind of reporting, what I often say to them is, I think that this would have been sound advice to give myself, back then, spend a few months of the year. If you're in a position where you can do this, spend a few months of the year doing a job that doesn't zap your brain, save up your money, and then go and make a run at it for 2 months. And even if you don't have an employer or no one's sending you, act as though you do and take yourself seriously and have the discipline to do it. And so I was doing this in radio, and then I started writing, and I never got paid for any of this. I started writing articles and would send them to Common Dreams or Alternet or Counterpunch, from these places because I wanted to be a journalist. And if no one was going to pay me to do it, I was going to figure out a way to do it anyway. And I basically, you know, as I learned the craft or learned the trade of journalism, I started to become more interested in actual investigative reporting and digging deeper than just simply trying to facilitate giving voice to people who didn't have one, but actually figuring out why are they being targeted? Who are the people that are benefiting from these policies? And it was a journey that took me to New Orleans, where I met Blackwater guys on the streets. And that's how I started writing the Blackwater book, back to Iraq, and then ultimately to Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia. But it was all very much, it was part of like sort of growing up, you know, it was baby steps.
And you're quite young.
I'm 38, but...
No, I mean, yeah. I don't mean now. Quite young for even that. But, I mean, since you drop out of college, you start working with Amy, you're...
Yeah, exactly. I was a kid. I mean, I was, this would have been... Yeah, I was like 20, 22 or so.
Yeah,
or
so
like
even this point, actually, you're in your mid-20s, and, and you're teaching yourself as you go.
Right. And I learned from people in community radio. I mean, that was really... I mean, I was a radio junkie, and I volunteered for every show at WBAI. I would record pieces for the Cuba show that aired at 3 in the morning, and then I would cut pieces for the weekend show. Anytime anyone would let me do anything, I would do it. And I ended up producing stories for totally for nothing. I mean, like as all of us do, we all work and volunteer in these radio stations. That's how they're powered. But just saying to people, like, it never was about like, how can I figure out a career? I loved it. That's what I wanted to do. I lived in that radio station basically, and that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a reporter.
Wow. To me, your current, what you're doing these days and the success you're having is I would say, one of Pacifica's better products at this point.
Well, I owe a lot to Pacifica. I mean, it was, and a lot of people do. I mean, these stations, and that's why it's so important to protect them and to keep them on the air, are in many cases the only community media that exists in various cities. And they're places that give an opportunity to young people who don't have any skills in radio or something to come in and volunteer and learn a trade.
If you've got the passion and you're willing to live that, you know, just you're not sure where the rent comes from next month, maybe.
Yeah, it also is a privileged thing to have that. And I'm aware of that, too. I mean, there are a lot of people who are single parents or are keeping afloat many other people other than themselves. So, I mean, I think I was fortunate that this happened to me at a period in life when I didn't have much responsibility and didn't have to think about, you know, where the next check comes from. I was kind of living on couches, basically, and going around. It was what I wanted to do. But I realize also it's from a position of privilege that you're able to do something like that. And I never forget that. I mean, and I'm careful when I talk to people about it that it's not like, oh, anyone can do this. It's not true. You have to, you know, there's some degree of privilege that you operate with.
There's got to be a bit of a safety net under you to be able to do that. This is Freeform. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Jeremy Scahill. We're going to talk about the revelations in his book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And to learn more, you can go to dirtywars.org and thenation.com because he is a correspondent with The Nation and has a really solid archive there, so you can trace a lot of his work there. And the new book is a Nation book.
It is, yeah, which is great. I mean, what's funny when you do something that has any kind of commercial success, which, I mean, the Blackwater thing was so surreal to me because I really thought I was just going to be selling that book out of a backpack. I mean, I honestly did. I was paid almost nothing to write that book. I almost had to beg them to publish it. I thought I was going to be selling it out of a backpack, but it ended up largely because of community media becoming a sort of underground hit and sold a lot of copies. And then after that, I was getting flooded with offers, huge offers to write books from big corporate publishers. And I mean, I remember one conversation, someone offered me an enormous amount of money and they said, you don't even have to have a specific book in mind. We'll just sign it. I mean, the reason I'm bringing this up is because I believe in independent media and I could have gone down a different path. I was getting offers to also write for like big glossy magazines and stuff, and I've never done it. I don't do it and I don't want to do that. I believe in building independent media. So I stayed with Nation Books because I believe in supporting independent press and working with people whose political values track with mine. And so that's why I'm a Nation Books author.
As I may have noted, it is the Dirty Wars is the number 5 bestseller in hardcover nonfiction.
I found out about that when you tweeted it. I was kind of blown away by that. I didn't know that, and then I had to fact check it. I was like,
Am I just promoing?
Right, you're trying to trick people into listening to the show. No, yeah, I was blown away by that. It's very.
And I think you said the highest charting book in Nation Books history.
It's amazing.
Very exciting.
was just a paper hanger. No one more obscurer. Got a phone call from the Reichstag, told me I was Führer. Germany was blue. Oh, 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 what to do? Hitched up my pants and conquered France. Now Deutschland's smiling through. We are crossing borders. The new world order is here. Make a great big smile. Everyone sing heil to me. Wonderful me. And now it's springtime
for Hitler and Germany.
Now for something completely different.